This is Deanna Spingola. It is Saturday, April 27th, 2013, and this is one of my special interviews. We have no commercials, no censorship, no calls, and no music. It is just education and information. It is bare bones broadcasting. My guest today is Veronica Clark. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. How are you?
Good. It's been such a long time since we've talked.
Yes, it has, though I have done some videos in the interim.
And you've been busy with getting 5 new books out.
Right. And those originally, 4 of them started out as just the ebooks, and so they're printed versions now. I'm doing all of my own covers. All of the artwork is mine, and all of the typesetting is now mine. I'm doing all of my books completely.
Oh, the artwork is amazing. Absolutely amazing. Let's see, which one is my... My favorite, is managing our perception of the Third Reich. Those teeth, that is so brilliant.
Oh, the wolf thing,
yes,
superimposed.
It is so yeah. Brilliant. And World Masonry, World Free Masonry Unveiled.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let me just mention to the listeners the titles. Managing Our Perception of the Third Reich. World Freemasonry Unveiled, The Controversy of Black Nazis 2, The Other Nazis, and Werewolves of the Iron Cross, Albion, and Zion United. And I like your subtitle, The Britsy Jutsy World Menace.
Right. And that's now going to be part of at least my repertoire. And I know some people didn't appreciate it. And Wilf is all, I don't know about that, but I'm keeping it there.
Yeah.
And there is going to be a second book to this.
Great.
There's a second part.
Super. And I'm just so proud of you that you're doing all your typesetting and all that stuff. And very professional. Oh, my goodness. These are very, very professional.
Well, thank you. I mean, it takes a while. And every time if something gets edited, it'll push down the text and there might be where a paragraph space gets removed or whatever.
Right.
If anyone sees anything, any typos, any missing spaces, just let me know. The email address is in every single book. Not a big deal. The files can now be corrected. Anything prior to Albion and Zion can't be corrected because those are all PDFs that are uneditable.
Right.
And I'm just not up to redoing all those books from scratch.
No, so, and you shouldn't have to.
Yeah,
really.
Those are going to have to stay. There's a couple typos here and there in those old ones, but very few.
Right. Well, every book, there's a mistake in every single book because people are the editors and people make mistakes. So
yeah.
In
fact,
okay.
this NLP book we're going to go over is actually a very professionally done book and a textbook, and it's loaded with them. Just loaded.
Okay,
so I guess we can start. What we're going to talk about today to begin with is what's called neuro-linguistic programming. And the book I'm basing the talk on is called Introducing NLP, Psychological Skills for Understanding and Influencing People. And these are just important skills to have for anyone. It really is an outstanding book. It kind of will change your whole view of how you think about learning, your relations with other people, how you negotiate, just any number of things. It's one of those perception changers. And of course, it's important to study psychology and psychiatry and any of those principles because, as we know, our favorite people use them against us all the time.
Exactly.
So they're masters of those fields.
They kind of created some of it. I mean,
absolutely. So we should definitely study it. I'm just going to start with this one quote from the book first. And this is George Bernard Shaw. Reasonable men adapt themselves to the world. Unreasonable men adapt the world to themselves. That's why all progress depends on unreasonable men. And I thought the first thing that came to my mind was Hitler when I read that. I'm like, yep, they basically, NLP is kind of a branch of psychology that can teach you to create a new context for yourself and in this way change the world. Of course, we can't all be like Hitler and change the circumstances so much so that we get into leadership and start a revolution. But it's something to shoot for, and it's important that people realize that they don't really have limitations other than the ones they deliberately impose on themselves.
Right.
So this kind of helps you break out of those limitations. So the first thing is, what is NLP? And basically, the way they describe it is the art and science of personal excellence. Art, because everyone brings their unique personality and style to what they do, and this can never be captured in words or techniques. And then science, because there is a method and process for discovering the patterns used by outstanding individuals in any field to achieve their outstanding results. So that would literally be like dissecting what it was that any given person that you admire does to make them admirable or to make them successful. You are literally breaking down the very steps to see what it is about them, what they do, how they act, what they say, their whole MO, if you will, their whole persona, what makes them successful and able to achieve what they do. And it could even be psychopathic behavior. That's important to realize too, that we understand that, hey, this particular individual is a psychopath, therefore they've been able to crawl and, you know, claw their way to the top, which psychopaths do. They step on many heads to the top.
Right.
So that's certainly something you can look at too. You want to see positive and negative. And then this process is called modeling, of course, and pattern skills and techniques so discovered are being used increasingly in all different fields, counseling, education, personal development, etc. So basically, yes, you're looking at modeling those who are successful. Just jumping ahead here, we're going to look at the four stages of learning. And so they go over learning, unlearning, and relearning. And what was kind of interesting is, and we don't think about this, but consciously, we can only take in a tiny bit of the world just in our lives and also in our daily lives. We notice and respond to a lot more unawares. Almost our whole existence is unconscious. Heartbeat, breathing, just whatever's in the brain and stored there, your whole life, all your memories, everything, is right there at instant recall, constantly going on in the background, and yet no one even thinks about it. Right. We think about 7 variables at any given time. That is our maximum in our conscious mind. So that's why we chunk things. For example, a phone number. You're not actually memorizing every single individual digit, but chunks. So that's why they have an area code of 3 numbers, because you chunk those into one element, and then the next 3, and then the next 5. I know foreign countries have slightly different ones, but it's still chunking.
That's
so
the same.
That's kind of an interesting thing.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
That's like in speed reading. People don't read each word individually. They read a sentence or a paragraph all at one time. And
right.
They just, yeah.
And that could be one thing where someone wants to learn how to speed read. This is an example of where one could apply NLP. Okay, I want to be able to just look at a page or a paragraph and get the idea that quick. Let's see. The 4 stages of learning. First, we start to learn. We soon discover our limitations, obviously. If you want to start playing tennis and you can't even hit the ball, you go, okay, obviously I need to work on lots of things. So this is the stage of what they call conscious incompetence. When you grind the gears, oversteer, give cyclists heart attacks, for example, when you're first learning to drive.
Mm-hmm.
You really have no idea what you're doing. So the next stage is where you're led to conscious competence. You can drive the car, but it takes all your concentration still. You've learned the skill, but you have not yet mastered it. And this can apply to anything, not just driving. They just use driving as an example. And then lastly, and the goal of the endeavor, the ultimate goal, is unconscious competence. And this is where the brain literally takes these little patterns that we've been working at, for example, shifting, clutch, steering, looking, glancing in mirrors, etc. you don't realize how much you're actually doing because it's unconscious now. It is a habit. And habits are, of course, absolutely necessary for any kind of functioning. So, of course, we can also develop a very bad habit, such as OCD. That would be where you have a ritualistic habit that you have to check your burners 18 times before you can leave the house. And it's the same process of learning. And oftentimes when somebody develops that OCD type learning, where they have a bad habit, it can be triggered by one bad event. For example, your grandmother burned down the house.
Oh, yeah.
That can actually induce a permanent, lifelong, obsessive, compulsive burner checking behavior or fire phobia behavior in any person. So OCD is extremely powerful in that respect because it's a one-time thing versus where you're slowly learning a skill. You know, it takes time to learn it. This is oftentimes why it's so hard to treat those negative habits like OCD. Interesting, because it's kind of based in a phobia, and phobias are hard to cure. But we'll go over their phobia cure, because NLP has an interesting one.
Now, you don't have to be OCD or obsessive compulsive. You can be just a little bit anal.
True.
And you don't have to have a phobia. I mean, I like details of things. And I want to make sure that everything falls in line, that I take care of my responsibilities. I'm very responsible. So, but I don't think that's being obsessive compulsive. I think that's just being responsible.
Right, exactly. And there is a difference. OCD is generally characterized where a person, like a drug addict, their whole world revolves around the ritual, the obsession, and the habit. This would be like, I remember watching a documentary of a young man who said that he only knew his father through the shower door, the bathroom door, because his father was OCD showering and hand washing.
Yikes.
He did it so much that he got himself skin infections and actually started losing flesh. That's OCD. And that's something that, you know, unfortunately is also in the unconscious competence category that is, you know, it's hard to treat, but
sure.
You know, that's an extreme case. But again, just going back over the four stages, we start out unconscious and competence. We don't know we stink at it until we try it.
Right.
Okay. Second, conscious incompetence. I start writing books. I realize, oh, gee, I could say this better. I've got a weakness here because I read this book and it contradicts what I say. And I think this one's right. So now I have to incorporate this into here. Okay. So I realize where my errors are and I'm going to improve them. Three, conscious competence. Now I'm working at the skill and I'm getting better and better and better. And then fourth, unconscious competence, where I am so good at writing. I have literally mastered the art of writing. I can't make a mistake or very rarely make a mistake. This is hypothetically what a PhD should be, is a real true master of the art of whatever, history.
Mm-hmm.
Political science, whatever. As we know, that's just not how it goes.
Right.
Which is why I like that Nietzsche quote, there are no facts, only interpretations. I just love that. And I put that on my site. So, okay. So then the three things, this is his 3-minute seminar on NLP. If we were to have to explain it really quickly. Firstly, know what you want. You have to have a clear idea of your outcome, your goal in any situation. Number two, be alert and keep your senses open so that you notice what you're getting. If you're going off on left field and you don't realize it because you're just not paying attention, then you're not being alert. Obviously, you have no acuity. Thirdly, you have to have flexibility. You have to keep changing what you do until you get what you want. This is where one cannot be rigid. I'm sure all of us have known rigid people that go, no, it's this way or nothing's going to work. It has to be this way. And if I don't get this goal at the end of this process, then I'm just going to give up. I've known many people like that. So the three things, outcome, acuity, flexibility. And that would be the real keys of NLP. And of course, the aim, the end goal of going through NLP, say you go to, they have NLP meetups where people can practice this with other people that are interested in it. You can go to seminars, you can buy more books about it, whatever you want to do. It's to give you more choice about what you do with your life, what you do in life. So one would hope that, say, a heroin addict who goes into NLP therapy would see that, you know, there's more to life than going and getting high. You don't have to be limited here. Look at your opportunities. You can go to a methadone clinic where you're taken care of, which would then enable you to go get a job part-time. Okay, maybe your family, maybe your mother, you finally go to her and say, you know, I want to clean up my life. May I borrow a car? Do you have anything, you know, any means of transportation for me? So then you're giving yourself that choice that you have transportation now, which opens other doors, et cetera. Stop limiting yourself to like, I'm just going to be a heroin addict the rest of my life, blah, blah, blah. And just that kind of stuff.
Right.
And it can be anything. So you're trying to give yourself more choice, more control over your life. We are not victims of circumstance. That's what NLP teaches.
And that's neuro-linguistic. I want to say Linguini. Linguini.
You know, yeah, linguistic.
I must be hungry.
I like yours better. That's what we'll call it. Okay, so let's start with outcomes or goals. Okay, one would hope that everybody would be doing something in life to achieve a goal. Now, when people, the big thing with me is addictions. I harp on this because it just so happens I am in an area that is exploding with heroin meth addiction.
Really?
It's really bad. Yeah, our crime rate's skyrocketing. I attribute it largely to the economy, price of gas, many different factors. But in my particular area, it is absolutely exploding. And so basically, people that go to those things, meth, heroin, whatever, addictions, what goal are they working towards? They're not working towards a goal. That's why they're an addict. If a person or a system, such as the U.S. government or the U.S. economy, can give people a goal to work towards, that keeps them away from the addiction process, the addiction cycle. And so what we're seeing in America, at least in my opinion, is that because there's no goals worth achieving in this country, there are less and less for average people because of the circumstances, because of our slow rot, collapse, etc. We're seeing more of this, more crime, more addiction. People are literally living just to get high kind of a thing. That's a sad place to be.
I think it's kind of deliberate. I think that people have altered the culture so mm-hmm. that there aren't enough choices. There are insufficient choices for people, such as going to college. It costs so much to go to college now. I mean, you're going to be in debt for the rest of your life if you do.
Right. Exactly. I am almost $50,000 in debt. But here's how NLP helped me think about my college debt. I said, you know, in my opinion, I tell myself, and they tell you to sit down with yourself and talk to yourself, we are many personalities. This is why the whole multiple personality thing, we are many different people in one. We have different sides. And so you sit down and you negotiate with your sides and you go, okay, you're $50,000 in debt. You got problems. They're going to come after your Social Security. You can't default. Big trouble. They take your tax, your tax refund?
Mm-hmm.
They garnish your wages, blah, blah, blah. It's debt that follows you to the grave. Literally, it can't be erased with bankruptcy, any of that. What students should do is instead of jumping out of the 20-story building, which an increasing number of students are doing, sit down, talk to yourself and say, hey, this is not the end of the world. Yeah, you have debt, but you know what? Your master's was worth it. Look at what you're doing with it. If you're not doing anything with your master's or your bachelor's degree, start doing something with it. It doesn't have to be what you majored in. Use the skills you've acquired in getting that degree and apply it to something, whether it is a silly job like, I don't know, some part-time thing where you're shoveling dirt, I don't care, picking fruit, working at McDonald's, it doesn't matter. Use the skills you've acquired to move up as high as you can in whatever you are in. And believe you me, the opportunities will come up around that. I've done it myself and it happens. I'm writing books as a result of getting my master's in history. Are my books perfect? No, but I continuously improve them. I read more and more books to expand my own thinking, my perception, to see more biases, to see where my limitations are, so that I can begin to then incorporate those theses and challenges into mine. I am using the skills I acquired for that price. To me, it was worth it. Now, I should not have done it, but I went through 1 year of PhD studies because I wanted to get a PhD in psychology. That's where I went wrong, because that was almost $30,000 for a year. But instead of crying about it, I not only joined a class action lawsuit against the university for misrepresenting the value of their degree, and it didn't work out. It went to arbitration, and the attorney that talked to me, he said, look, you can take them on in arbitration. I've never done an arbitration. It's risky. I don't feel comfortable doing it, but I'm going to leave it up to you. I decided to opt out because if I lose the arbitration, I have to pay my fees and
theirs.
City's fees.
Right.
And he said it could be as much as $11,000. I'm like, no, that's okay. But instead of crying about losing, I said, let me look at this as this is another strike against these universities and this system that is slowly building as more and more defaults and more debt accrue. I'm actually the kind of person that would advocate a strategic student default, where I believe that every single student in the United States of America should get together and default. And if every single student did it, it would absolutely collapse the American economy within a week.
Mm-hmm.
Easily. The whole student loan industry, they wouldn't even know where to begin. But see, this is where we can't get the collective action. There is one student who could be doing this right now, but isn't. He just so happens to be Jewish. He's trying to advocate a softer approach. We don't want to default. We want to work with Congress. You can't work with criminals. You need to strategically default. Anyway,
exactly.
Point is, I look at my debt differently. I am not going to pay my student loan debt because I can't. I do not have the money. And so I'm eligible for deferment, income-based repayment, etc. People have choices. Control your circumstances. Do not go jump out the window. That's just my approach. There is something called the income-based repayment plan. If you make no money or very limited money, you do not have to pay a cent back to the government for your student loan, but they count it as though you did. So if you pay $0 a month or even $100 a month, which is saying just totally based on your income, it counts as a payment either way. Every student loan, as long as it's being paid on, disappears after 20 years. It just magically goes off your credit.
Oh, it goes, that's nice.
So just hang in there for 20 years, you guys, and we'll I'm counting the years.
Oh,
just
goodness.
A different way of thinking about it. That's how NLP helped me with that.
Good.
So I was depressed at first, too. I'm thinking, $50,000, what am I going to do? You know, you think of it as a world-crushing event, but at this point, debt's just, it's one of those quaint little.
Right. Everybody has it, it seems.
Yeah. And it's exploding. Student debt's $1.1 trillion now, so I don't think any of us are going to be paying anything back.
Right.
Okay, so know what you want, and you need to have a positive outcome. You need to state what you want positively. You can't say, I'll never get that because of this. One cannot have that attitude. And if one does have that attitude, I never, I can't, I'm this, I'm that, what starts to happen is one starts to get depression. And this can quickly evolve into depressive disorder, where one cannot think of the world in any terms other than through that depression veil. I've known many people with depression. It's really very unpleasant to experience people with that. So think positive. You don't have to be Pollyanna, but just make the best of your situation because it is what it is. There's no point in being negative. And be positive about your goals. You can achieve what you want to achieve. You may not get 100% there. You may pass away before the process is complete, but you're working towards it. People should always have something positive that they're working towards, and you may achieve it. And you can also create the circumstances oftentimes to achieve it, but we have to be careful not to set our aims too high. Me saying I'm going to be president in 2 years, that's stupid, and I shouldn't get depressed if I don't achieve that. A more realistic, positive goal for me, if that was my ultimate aspiration, which it isn't, by the way, but if it was, I could say, I'm going to get on the school board next year. And then from there, I'm going to try to become a mayor of my town. And, you know, you'd work in smaller steps, of course.
Sure.
Then maybe get in with the Rothschilds. And
right. Then you could do it in one giant step.
That's right. Okay, so let's see. Do I need to go over anything? Resources. Okay, so that's basically what we just went over. Do you have the resources to initiate and maintain your outcome? How will you know you've achieved your outcome or your goal? What signs are you going to see? What is the evidence that you know you've gotten there? And you need to think of your goals specifically. For example, if I'm the heroin addict who's now on daily methadone and I'm pregnant, my specific goal would be I am going to stop using methadone 2 days a week for the next 6 months of my pregnancy so that my child is not as bad as it could be if it's born. That's realistic for me as a methadone addict. It is helping my child. It is specific. I am being detailed. It is something that I can achieve if I was in that circumstance. So being realistic, being detailed, being specific. And then, of course, your goal has to be the appropriate size. We're not all going to go out and reclaim Germany.
No.
Take a swath of Poland. And so just be realistic again, not something that's so huge. And that's where we look into stepping up and stepping down. So here's your goal. And if you step up, if I got this outcome, what would it do for me? Where am I going with this? And then that leads you then to your larger outcome. And then if your outcome needs to be taken down a step, what prevents me is stepping down. So my goal would be, okay, I want to start a business. What prevents me from starting a business at this moment right here and now? I don't have the money. Okay, so my smaller outcome, if I step down, is going to be, how do I get the money? Should I start putting away a little bit every year? You know, that would be stepping down. And then eventually I'd get to my larger outcome of being an independent business owner. So those are just those steps. Next, we'll go to conscious attention versus unconscious habits. We've really already gone over this, but basically, things that require your conscious attention are such a small part of your life, and yet they tend to be the most impactful. For example, if I'm constantly consciously attending to a memory of, say, a rape 10 years ago that happened to me, I am not living in the here and now. I'm not paying attention to all the good things in my life in my unconscious. I am allowing that one past memory to dictate my present state, to control my present, to control the rest of my life, basically. This is where NLP treatment would help you deal with that conscious habit of continually remembering that in the present, push that aside and bring up other things. It's a systematic way of bringing unconscious things to the surface, dealing with them so that your conscious can be attending to other more important things. Not necessarily more important, but more important for your well-being.
Right, more productive, more so that you can progress and move away from that thing.
Exactly. And we've already gone over habits. Habits are unconscious. If I'm clicking my fingers while I'm talking to somebody or tapping my foot, I'm not aware of that habit. Maybe somebody needs to make me aware and say you need to quit doing that. So that might be your goal, to work on some of your bad habits. Or if somebody has good habits, maintain those. You know, not right. a big deal. Maybe somebody sees that someone has good habits, like they get up every Sunday morning, go to church, habitual, they never miss it. They're such a great person. Every time you encounter them, they're just wonderful and happy, which I actually knew a couple that was just like that. They were the happiest people on earth. And we called them that. We called them the happiest people on earth. And so what I do is I go, I want to be more like them. So what are the habits they have? And again, it's unconscious to them. They're not even aware they're really doing it. As far as outcome summary, I think we've really gone over that too.
But getting back to this couple, sometimes we have different perceptions of people. We see them, well, you said at church, and and people, when they go to church, tend to have this persona about them that they want to impress other people. Well, I'm very righteous and look how happy we are. But maybe at home they're, you know, the husband's yelling at the kids and maybe they're not so happy, but they have to have this presence depending on the group of people that they are associating with, so that they match or at least feel comfortable in that setting.
And that's true. And of course, if we were modeling somebody and going, I want to be more like them, we would probably discover those things.
Right.
These particular people happen to be restaurant goers. They were always at our restaurant and they were just... They were amazing. I got a hand nut to them. They were amazing. And I know they talked about church occasionally and they would come every day after church. But here's something interesting. Those people come into people like that. They come into a restaurant on a Sunday so that restaurant workers can't go to church and achieve that same goal. So that would be an example of where I recognize, hey, it's always at someone's expense. I need to be empathic about that. They're very empathic. They were very empathic people. But some people aren't. You know, they didn't even think twice. We're coming in, 20 of us from our church, la, 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 having fun. And all the restaurant workers are like running around with chickens with their heads cut off, being abused, yelled at, etc. That used to irritate me, especially when it was a big church group.
Sure. And they should be going home and keeping the Sabbath day holy.
That's right. Okay, so our outcome summary. If you just remember the mnemonic posers spelled out by the first letter of the keyword for each step, and people can read what that is in the book, but basically positive, think of what you want rather than what you do not want.
Repeat the name of the book again.
It is Introducing NLP, Psychological Skills for Understanding and Influencing People, and it's by Joseph O'Connor and John Seymour. I think I paid $1. I have the purple one, but they have a new updated one.
Oh, right. Yes, I have the new updated
one. I think it has a green cover.
Yeah.
So ask, what would I rather have? What do I really want? Don't say, I don't want this. And this is something that groups and individuals are constantly doing. I know what I don't want. I don't want. I don't want. That gets old. What do you want? Not what you don't want. Okay, I already know what you don't want. So that would be positive. Own part. Think of what you will actively do that is within your control. So you're owning part. You ask, what will I be doing to achieve my outcome? How can I start and maintain it? Specific. Imagine the outcome as specifically as you can. Ask who, where, when, what, and how specifically. Okay, if you need money to start your business, how are you specifically going to go do that? Are you going to rob a bank? Are you going to ask your mom, or are you going to save some for yourself? If so, how much? Are you realistically going to dedicate from each paycheck maybe $5? And then specifically, how long is it going to take you to achieve the amount of money you need to start that business? Those kind of things.
Mm-hmm.
Evidence. Think of the sensory-based evidence that will let you know you have got what you want. So you ask, what will I see, hear, and feel when I have it? How will I know that I have it? Obviously, with a business, you're going to see your product, your website maybe, your sales, income, you're going to feel good. Resources. Do you have adequate resources and choices to get your outcome? Ask, what resources do I need to get the outcome? And one of the number one resources Americans are overlooking or lacking is family. Family is extremely important. So these self-made man, entrepreneur, I'm out on my own, I'm self-made, that is a myth. That is a horrific lie. There is always somebody that helped you get where you are. Steve Jobs, Bill Gates, Chuck Schumer, I don't care who you are. They are not self-made men, not one of them. And in some of our cases, we rely on a vast network of our people. That's where Americans are really lacking. I would say especially with European Americans. No one goes, let me think about my Anglo-Saxon neighbor and how they might be able to help me or whatever the case is, or my German neighbor if you're German. Nobody thinks that way. Mm-hmm. But what I have found is my Mexican friends and coworkers will deliberately seek out fellow Mexicans and support their businesses and buy cars from them, etc. They really look out for one another. And that is to be respected and encouraged because it's a good thing. But we need to do it too. You know,
right.
Maybe you should hire the Anglo-Saxon gardener if you're white or whatever the case is, or the German gardener. I don't care what it is. We used to go to a German mechanic for our Volkswagens. We did that deliberately because they're German made and he was the best. He was from Germany and the guy knew his stuff. He could like build a Volkswagen from scratch. So we deliberately made that choice and supported him, even though there were mechanics who were cheaper and closer to our house. Size. Is the outcome the right size? If it is too large, ask, what prevents me from getting this? And turn the problems into other smaller outcomes. Make them clear and achievable. If it is too small to be motivating, ask, if I got this outcome, what would it do for me? Oftentimes, smokers, I think, set their standards too low. I'm going to quit smoking.
Tomorrow.
Why? What? Smokers need to say, I'm going to quit smoking because I don't want emphysema. I can foresee myself in the future breathing through one of those little things with a funky voice, and I don't want that for me. That's more of a motivator. Then take yourself out of the smoking context. You do not go sit and smoke in the same spot out with your buddies. Quit going there, because when you put yourself in the context, you can't do it. It's harder. Because that context brings back the feelings and you go, ugh, I want to smoke.
Right.
It has a lot to do with where you are. And these are what's called anchors. And we're going to get into that shortly. So, of course, that's the last part of the poser's thing. And we can go ahead and go to present versus desired state. This is basically where, okay, I am here writing these books. I'm a small author. This is my present state, but I want to be a huge publisher with my own printing press. So my present state versus my desired state. So now I have to go, okay, what do I need to do to achieve my desired state? And of course, this can also be internal, a state of being, a state of feeling. If I have depression, say I'm diagnosed with clinical depression and the doctor is like throwing Zoloft at me. Okay, please take this. I go, wait a minute. My present state, okay, yes, I'm depressed. I have this, this, and this. My life is so horrible. Oh, Lord. What can I do to achieve the desired state of not being depressed as far as my internal state of being? Okay, maybe I should take up exercising every day. Maybe I should join a group on meetup.com or something like that. Go for a weekly run. It doesn't matter. Whatever it is, it's a matter of changing your internal state. And of course, we can also change our external state. I want to move from Los Angeles, aka hell, to another state like wonderful North Dakota, which pays $10 an hour even if you work at McDonald's. So that would be another example of changing your external state.
And taking the responsibility to do this yourself and not relying on an MD, a doctor, to fix it via chemicals.
You can't fix things. And here's the problem with a lot of this. I did, during my psychology studies, I learned a lot about the repercussions of giving drugs later on. For example, Ritalin causes cocaine addiction to be much more likely and much more difficult to stop in adults, in teenagers and adults. So if you raise your child on Ritalin, you are more likely to have at least a cocaine addict, if not worse, in the future. We need to think about this because it literally changes the way the brain works. We are chemical beings. Our brain is pure electrochemistry. You can't just throw a drug into that system and not expect other sectors to be seriously affected and the whole system to change. This is the problem with drug addiction. And in studying heroin addiction, for example, the initial high, the first time somebody does heroin, is never, ever, ever achieved again. It is a one-time maximum high. What keeps people doing it, at least initially, not necessarily with heroin, because this is extremely addictive, so much so that you get dope sick if you quit using it and you will die. Your body literally becomes dependent on heroin. But with any other drug, it's the expectation of the original one-time high that keeps people using. It has nothing to do with what high you're actually getting. It's, I want that first-time high that they think they're going to keep getting, or they think they're getting that they're not. And ultimately, it changes the brain to where your brain no longer releases serotonin or dopamine unless you have the drug in your system. That this is why a lot of drug users coming down are utterly depressed. It completely changes the brain. And as far as I can tell, once a person is a drug addict for long enough, it really is a lifelong addiction. It's a lifelong change. One must understand that if one is going to start using drugs, maybe they should understand initially, and their parents should tell them this, whatever, maybe a friend, anything. This is going to be with you the rest of your life. You are never going to be the same person ever, ever again. You can get some of what you had back. Sometimes. Sometimes you don't. A lot of LSD people never come back, and they're nutcases for the rest of their lives because it was a bad trip. But if you're one of the lucky ones, what I've found is the drug addicts still long for the drug. It doesn't go away. The longing doesn't go away. What you can do as an ex-addict is control the longing. You can say, I really want to do LSD, or I really want to do heroin. Gosh, I miss it, but I'm not gonna. Your willpower stops you. That's what people should be told. This is going to be with you the rest of your life. It's going to completely change you. You're always going to want to go back to drugs because it's so powerful chemically. This is why Parkinson's people, you know, my dad has Parkinson's, they actually give them what's called L-DOPA because the brain stops producing dopamine. And so the L-DOPA, which is a form of amphetamine, it's basically meth and it causes hallucinations and a lot of other things. It induces the dopamine release. And so without it, I mean, a Parkinson's patient gets completely dependent on L-DOPA. Whether or not it makes the disease go faster and get worse faster, I don't know. But I just know that many Parkinson's victims cannot survive without it. So in my opinion, it's a good treatment. But we just need to understand that if pharmaceutical drugs work like that, do we not think street drugs work like that?
Right.
And then just, I don't know, people need to be more aware of the consequences of like a temporary behavior.
Now, what about cannabis? What about marijuana? That is a natural substance.
It is. And you know what I read in my biopsychology text? And this was very interesting. It's by the guy's last name is Pinel, P-I-N-E-L. He could not come up with one study, not one, to indict marijuana. Not one. Now, in some people, if they use it lifelong and abuse it, it can induce psychosis and paranoia. Ultimately, with a drug like that, I would never endorse any kind of addiction. I'm anti anything. I don't believe in drinking alcohol. I don't believe in being like a pot addict. If someone is doing that for health reasons, as part of a health regimen, and they're fully in control of it, that's totally different in my opinion. And it absolutely has health benefits. And this textbook also mentions that. But I mean, he flat out admitted marijuana doesn't cause really anything, and alcohol is a million times worse.
Oh, absolutely. I don't drink or smoke. The only addiction I have, and it's really not an addiction, I just kid about it. I like dark chocolate.
Oh, lovely. It's loaded with antioxidants.
Right.
So is coffee, by the way. I admit I do drink coffee.
I don't drink coffee.
Really bad.
And I don't drink soda.
Right. Sodas are really bad. No, but yeah, with marijuana, you know, I'm not the type that would endorse, oh yeah, we should all smoke pot. And I really have no respect for the quote unquote stoners. Uh-huh. People that live the lifestyle and they're like, hey man, happy go lucky. I can't dig it. You know what I mean?
Yes, exactly.
Usually those people are not just smoking marijuana, though.
Right.
That's at least what I've found. They dabble in other things. But yeah, there's really nothing bad about that. And in fact, it has many benefits. Hemp itself, the plant, if one buys hemp oil, the cooking oil, one can get any of this on Amazon. They have a load of products from a company called Nutiva in Canada. It's all legal. Hemp protein powder. It's amazing. If you're lacking energy, anything, that hemp protein by Nutiva is absolutely incredible. The hemp oil is loaded with omega-6, omega-9, omega-3, ALA, GLA, all the good oils for you, all the good fats.
Now, that's hemp seed oil that you're talking about rather than hemp oil.
Yeah, exactly. Hemp seed oil. Right. But I mean, there's all kinds of great things from that plant. It's obvious why they're controlling it, but yeah.
Sure. Oh, absolutely. Because they can't put a patent on it, so they have to criminalize it.
Well, wait a minute, though, Deanna. They're going to patent human genes.
Yeah.
Monsanto.
Oh, dear.
If they can patent a human being, why can't they patent? Isn't that outrageous?
Yes. Amazing.
Okay. I have a vendetta against Monsanto. Okay, so going on, so present versus desired state. How about communication? What I found with the internet is that communication is severely inhibited. When we are talking to a person, we are doing more than just talking at a person. We are literally feeling them out. Can I say something about, say, the Third Reich to this person and not have them explode? You feel them out. It's a loop. It's a cycle and process of reaction, action, reaction. So maybe I would start feeling somebody out. I get to know them over a period of maybe, say, 6 months. Talking in conversations, I get a feel for how they are politically, et cetera, et cetera. However they respond to my questions and my personality, my presentation, is how I'm going to respond to them in turn. If they totally go cold fish on me, if I mention something about Hitler, I don't do it again. It's okay, I see where this is. But what we find is we don't want to talk to people that aren't receptive. We get away from them and we go on to the person who is. This is why we see people getting with like-minded people. It is totally natural to be with others that are like us. And this is, again, the process of communication. It isn't a cause and effect thing. It is a loop. Now, with the internet, you don't have that. You can't see the person's reaction. You
exactly.
have nothing going on the other side. So in a way, the internet inhibits us greatly.
But you also can't make assumptions. For instance, I was kind of negotiating to schedule somebody on my program, and we kind of set some tentative dates, and mm-hmm. then the person or her her assistant emailed me and said, she would like to talk to you before she's on your program.
Okay.
And I just immediately assumed that she found out that I was an anti-Semite.
Oh, no!
And just decided, oh, I bet that's what it is.
Uh-huh.
But it turned out it wasn't that at all.
Oh, good. That's always a good thing. I'm just busy right now. You're all, oh, geez. Isn't
I was
that
just
funny?
Feeling persecuted for
you're all getting that feeling of foreboding. Yeah, that does happen to me quite often, actually. I'm like, oh boy. Weird little things pop up in my life too. Like, I'll see a magazine cover where somebody drew a Hitler mustache on it, and I'm like, really? Is this following me? Do they know me? Just all kinds of things like that are very weird. A red, white, and black wedding. Right. Really? Who uses that color theme? I always joke about it with people I know that are trusting, but it's funny. It follows me wherever I go. Or maybe I'm just noticing it more because I'm more perceptive.
Sure.
But okay, so on top of that, communication is more than just words as well. And see, this is where the internet is obviously a limit, unless we're making a video. It's about your postures, gestures, and expressions. Everything we do is communication. If we're sitting there like falling asleep in a chair at a party, we are saying, I'm bored or I'm extremely tired without even saying anything. Okay, everything we do. And then what I found very interesting is that words are only a very tiny part of our expressiveness as human beings. And research shows that in a presentation before a group of people, over half, 55% of the impact is determined by your body language. This would explain why Hitler was so effective, huh? And it's your posture, your gestures, your eye contact. And then 38% by your tone of voice. And only 7% by the actual content. So the audience isn't even listening to what you're saying. They're just going, gosh, he's cool.
Right.
And I love the way he talks.
Right.
It's so funny because if you listen to any recounting of any great orator, et cetera, or any great presentation from either reading about it in a memoir or hearing somebody reflect on it, that's all they're saying is, wow, the presentation. Did you see the way they did that? And they don't even remember anything what was said.
Right.
So that's important that we realize how powerful that is. So body language, 55%, voice tonality, 38%, words, content, what you're actually saying, 7%. The same might actually apply to a website. Maybe if you have music, beautiful pictures, all this kind of different stuff, your presentation, nobody's even reading what's on it. They're just going, gosh, this site is cool. And it impacts them that way. Could be the same thing. I don't know. There'd have to be more research there. But this is also a very important key of communication that we just don't think about consciously. The meaning of the communication is the response that you get. So if your intent was completely the opposite of the response you get, you didn't effectively communicate, and it's your fault. Isn't that interesting? So whatever response you get is the meaning of what was said. So even if you give the lousiest presentation of your life and everyone's like cheering you and flopping on the floor and it's just they're ecstatic, then it was an effective communication, even if it was the worst thing you've ever said and you fumbled everywhere and you didn't even make sense. Interesting. And then we go on to rapport. So when we see two people just going at it at a coffee shop or just, you know, really engaged in their conversation, what we'll notice is they'll be sitting the same. They'll kind of have the same posture,
right. Mm-hmm.
Same breathing. Same, they match each other. This is mm-hmm. called matching. We don't mimic, we match. Mimicking is an insult, matching is rapport. That's when people are in rapport. You will know simply by looking at two people talking whether they're in rapport. And that's also an interesting thing. If you cannot establish rapport with a person, you might as well just quit talking to them
right.
because it ain't happening. And you'll know, you know, we can we can read other people pretty well. I mean, I know when somebody just ain't digging what I'm saying. Or if somebody's sitting there with their hands folded and you're not, and they're kind of turned away from you a little bit, you might want to take that as a sign that
and they're texting. They're texting their friends.
Text. Yeah, they're wait. Well, hold on one second. I need to take this call. Person really in rapport with you is going to ignore the ringing. It's but I just don't like the whole cell phone thing either. Ew! If you have a cell phone call, please ignore it. I don't care how eloquently cell phones are done. I find it irritating when people answer their phone when they're talking to somebody.
Oh, absolutely.
You really are sending the message, even though you may not mean it at all. You're telling the other person this call is more important than you.
Oh, absolutely.
It really mm-hmm. is the meaning of what that gesture. So that's an important NLP thing. We need to be aware that when we do that, sitting with somebody, that's the message we're sending, even if the other person acts like it's no big deal. They're lying to you.
Right.
So I go, oh, no problem. And you know what? I'm irritated by it.
And that's happened to all of us when we've been talking with somebody and then somebody else comes along and the person that you were talking to that you thought was interested in what you were saying says, oh, and then they turn away from you and start talking to somebody else.
Exactly.
Oh, my.
You know you don't have a rapport.
Exactly.
Okay, so then we have pacing and leading, and this, again, is rapport and kind of going back to feeling people out. Once you have rapport, you can start to change your behavior and the other person will likely follow you. So you're really in rapport. You're standing in front of Starbucks, which call it Zio-bucks or Zionist bucks. Okay, so you're standing in front of Zio-bucks. You're talking. You're fully engaged. You say, hey, let's sit down. Would you like to get a cup of coffee? Something like that. That's where you are leading, and then they're going to follow you if they're in rapport. And the person will go along with you, and then it goes from there. We've all done it. We all know exactly what that is. And then as far as pacing, that's establishing the bridge to another person through rapport and respect. So leading is changing your behavior so the other person follows. And pacing is basically getting the feel of like maybe fitting into a group or getting someone to kind of follow you and start thinking like you do, or at least being empathic. You're kind of taking them in a new direction, if you will. We pace when we join up with like a new group. Say you're hanging out at, I don't know, a club, a bar, whatever, and your friend calls you over to a group. Okay, you have no idea what to say, who these people are, anything. You pace. You start to get basically the conversation, the gist. You're feeling people out. Hey, my name is such and such. And then you start pacing yourself into the group, and eventually you're the bomb for the night, maybe. I don't know. Mm-hmm. Whatever the case is, but that's pacing. And of course, you pace to establish rapport as well. So these are all bridging techniques. So once people get to know you and they're like, oh, this guy is so cool, then you can start being a leader. You start leading the conversation or the group or whatever. Let's see. We're actually at our second hour, so if you'd like to stop there, we can switch gears to the books.
Sure. Yeah, let's talk about your books. One thing with going back to body language.
Uh-huh.
You can actually get people to, well, for instance, if somebody were to come over to your house mm-hmm. and you were just sitting there and chatting and you had something else that you wanted to do, if you just move forward in your chair, they will get the message without you ever saying anything that you want them to leave.
Exactly. It's interesting, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's all kinds of things. And believe you, if somebody is sitting there with their legs crossed and their arms folded,
mm-hmm.
they're not receiving you.
Exactly.
They're not open to you. They're not telling you everything.
Right.
I actually catch myself doing that a lot, and it's because I have a lot to hide from people.
Right.
Or sometimes, you know what I mean? My views are not okay, and so I tend to sit defensively. But see, with NLP, it raises this to your awareness, and you go, wait, maybe I should sit differently. I need to be more approachable to people. if I were to have a problem with that, I don't have a problem with it, but I just find these nuances about me now that I didn't realize.
And sometimes women are more comfortable with their arms crossed in front of them than men would be. And so you have to also consider gender.
Right. I noticed Hitler is always standing with one hand on the other.
Huh.
You notice that? Almost every single picture, his arms are either folded or he's clasping one hand with the other, and it's always the same hand.
Huh.
Just interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if I were to model Hitler, say I want to be able to speak like him and have absolutely no fear, I would start to stand like he does, assume the posture, speak like he does, listen to the way he talks, try to emulate it as much as possible as my model. And in this way, this is another technique of NLP, I would take on those traits myself in order to become an effective public speaker.
Which he
definitely
was.
That's kind of the idea of modeling. Oh, he was, let's face it, the man, I don't know how he stood in front of those crowds and wasn't like, I can't do
petrified.
It.
Petrified.
What? Exact. He never, not one time got stage fright, to my knowledge. That's incredible. I mean, the New Kids on the Block just recently did a tour and one of their members got stage fright. John Knight. I mean, New Kids on the Block are like a boy band from my
year.
But it's like, dude, you've been doing this for how long? It happens. And yet, that's one public speaker that it never happened to. And just having the whole command of the audience and being able to do the gestures and to be almost, he was up there without even acknowledging really that there was a crowd there, in a sense, because it was a true performance. No notes. I mean, half the time he's speaking off the cuff.
Right.
I find it absolutely remarkable, especially given our clownish leaders today who have to read from a teleprompter and even read the word incorrectly if it's misspelled.
You mean like that, linguine?
That is embarrassing. Yes, linguine. Oh, man, can you imagine? There were a couple times our president did that and it was embarrassing. Or a lot of times I've noticed they'll be speaking and then they'll go off on a tangent and they never come back. And you're like, oh my, it's very embarrassing.
Yes.
That's happened a couple of times to our president and everyone's going, what is he saying? You can tell the crowd's going, you lost us, buddy.
Right.
They just don't have it. Well, that wouldn't be a good model to emulate in that case. So what I'll do is we'll talk about the books a little bit.
Okay.
And I'll talk about that Dowlin book too. But first I'm going to read a quote that kind of will wrap up our NLP, because this to me, this is the kind of communication that you are not going to get what you want. Now his intent may be, I want to save my race or whatever, but he just isolated like 90% of the world with this one. So I'll read it. So this unknown man writes, I'm not going to name who this is. He knows who he is as soon as he hears it. But if someone's going to tell me I need to stop using the word N or C for blacks and women, when it is indeed an accurate reflection of the individual at which it is directed, what they're telling me is to be nice, to turn the other cheek, to embrace the slave morality, to lie, to avoid telling the truth because the truth isn't politically correct. All this has ever led to is pandering to the mainstream that is owned and operated by Jews, the mainstream that will never actually support us as long as they cling to their false religion, liberalism, modernism, feminism, weakness. He goes on, trying to appeal, quote unquote, to women is an exercise in pointlessness. The alt-right's focus should be on recruiting young men, the fuel of revolution. Once the tide begins to turn, women will flock to the right like groupies swarming an indie rock guitarist who lives with his parents and doesn't have a job. Don't get me wrong. It's not that women should be unwelcome. It's that they're unimportant. They are sideshows, not the main act.
Oh, my gosh.
Wow! I'm not even going to say where I read that. I'm sure you can just guess comment section.
Unbelievable.
No. Well, sorry, but here's my question to people. I realize the intent. The intent is you're trying to stir up the men to go out on a revolutionary crusade, right? Okay. But the problem is you're isolating way too many people with that kind of communication. And number two, if in fact liberalism and feminism and all this stuff is weak, then why does it continue to win? Why is it so effective? See, the NLP thinker will go, wait a minute, we need to reevaluate here. Fascism, National Socialism, lost. Yes, the world ganged up on it, but why did the world gang up on it? How were the liberal Masonic groupings able to get the world to do that? Obviously, it's effective. It's more effective than fascism and National Socialism. That's where we're being honest. And then we can ask from there, what makes it more effective? Maybe we should emulate some of its features. But see, somebody like this, that's not even, it's totally out of the question. They're never going to achieve their goal because they don't really know what they want. They're going, I know what I don't want, but I don't really know what I do want. And they're not recognizing what is really effective. Nobody asks why the majority embraces liberal ideology, liberal values. Why is that? That's something I'm interested in. Why is that? I mean, we have, what, how many people just protested gay marriage in France? And yet, the government's going to pass that anyway.
Exactly.
And nobody's going to do a thing about it. They're just going to have their protest, and then it's all over. Government said yes. And then what's going to happen is eventually, slowly, they're going to embrace it.
Right. Well, it's just like Obamacare. Nobody wants it. I mean, even Congress doesn't want it.
Right.
And yet it's passed.
So why are these liberal leaders then so effective at getting what they want? Is it because Americans are afraid? Is it because we really, truly, deep down know that we're in a tyranny and we're afraid to raise our heads against it in a very real way? I suspect fear is really at the heart of it.
Oh, undoubtedly.
We're deathly afraid of our government. We won't say it. We cling to our guns. We feel like we have these weapons with which to fight the government. We do not. The government need only discontinue importing and producing ammunition, and your guns are worthless. We are deathly afraid of our government, and we must admit. Don't be in denial. We must first admit. I will admit, I am deathly afraid of the U.S. government. There is no government in this world, no people in this world that I personally fear more than the American government and the American sheeple. They're to be feared. And I see why Iran and the rest of the world is just so paranoid about America.
Oh, yeah, look what they've done to the world. My
yes,
word.
Exactly. We are a true tyrant.
Yep.
That whole Boston lockdown thing just showed it to me all the more. You know, the people just were cheering the police and they were kicking in doors and no nothing. Like, oh, it's fine.
Yeah. And the whole thing was staged to begin with in order for the police to exercise this power, I think, just to see how the people would react. And if people don't react, they're going to continue to do this sort of thing.
Right. And I hope the government knows, at least they can hear it from me, I don't believe a thing about the bombing.
No, I don't know. I don't either.
Biggest hoax. I don't know who was behind it or what, but it was so stupid. And the fact that the one boy was being treated by, what was it, an Israeli doctor?
Yeah, at an Israeli hospital.
And he was shot in the throat. How
convenient.
But then his admission, we were motivated by religion. That is the most contrived thing I've ever heard. They're going to have to try harder than that. Sorry, but that's incredible. Okay, so we'll go on to the books.
Okay.
It's just briefly about each one. First, we'll start with, let's start with World Freemasonry Unveiled. This is an original Third Reich publication. I have the pamphlet. It's translated into English for modern readers. And basically, this was put out by Der Aufbau, which was the authorized journal of the Office for Commerce and Trade of the NSDAP. So official NSDAP branch. And basically what the author does is reveal who the Masons are. We need only guess who the movers and shakers behind that are. Kind of the history of Masonry. It's very brief. He basically puts it all in a nutshell. Talks about how the Templar Order was originally a good organization, original Freemasonry, good organization, you know, not corrupted, but with this influence of these Jutsis, became corrupted. Right. Is this tyrant basically declaring war on all peoples, on the natural order, everything, mixing everything up? That's basically what happened with Freemasonry. And they also talk about how it's completely based in the Talmud and the Torah, which is, it's Hebraic. There is no getting around that. I mean, any even pro-Jewish reading of Masonry has to admit this. I know Springmeier does a lot on Masonry, but I've never read anything. Have you ever read anything of his?
I have, and I also had him on my program. It's been about a year ago.
Now, does he talk about the Jewish influence?
Yes.
Okay. So even your mainstream books or people who aren't necessarily going to pinpoint the Jews like the Germans did in this text are going to reveal that. Here's something interesting. The final goal of Freemasonry. We wish for chaos, the collapse, the revolution. And in the confusion of that time, we will create a new order based on the ideals of Freemasonry. That's a direct quote from Mason. That should make anyone a little uneasy.
We also see that in our government with all the crises and the false flags and all of the lack of confidence of the population in the government. I think they're doing this all on purpose. So that the population will say, oh, we need a better government. Maybe we should have world government, and then it'll be better.
Exactly. What they do is they take you in baby steps to the quote-unquote New World Order.
Right.
They want their end goal. So if anyone practices NLP, it's the Masons.
Right.
Exactly what they want. They know every step. They have end goal in mind. They've been around for a long time. They really don't have an equivalent. They really don't.
Right.
Fascism and National Socialism were almost their equivalent. I can't say they were their equivalent because they didn't win. Almost, though. Very close. So people who are of that persuasion, fascism, National Socialism, you need to think about what it was that made those movements not quite the equivalent and change that accordingly. Here's another interesting quote. This was admitted to in court in 1932. And I guess this is Caudenhove Kalergi. I'm not sure how to pronounce his name. He was Jewish. Very high degree Mason, probably 33rd. Quote, "The person of the future has to be a crossbreed or mixed race.
Ugh.
I wish for the future race of Pan-Europe to be a Eurasian-Negroid mixture, to have a multitude of personalities," end quote. The author of this wrote, "No comment," with an exclamation mark, original. Now, this is not to say we have to be racist and, oh my gosh, race mixing, oh, it's an evil tool, blah, blah, blah. There's always going to be some mixing between peoples. I think that is to be accepted. Even the NSDAP accepted that to a degree. What we have to ask, though, is this intention of this Mason a positive one or a negative one being wielded as a weapon? I think it's pretty obvious.
Right.
This is a weapon in the Masonic arsenal. Knowing that, we do need to think of that agenda differently. It doesn't mean you have to hate. It doesn't mean you have to freak out about race mixing and go shoot a white girl who marries a black man, which is abhorrent, in my opinion, and calling them the S word and the C word and all this other garbage. It means vigilance. It means creating the context of a new reality for the world. Maybe we all need to be the ones that say, you know, because that's a weapon and because that's a goal of Masonry and I oppose Masonry or what I call Mazism, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to make a different choice. I want to preserve my race or my people or whatever. But we shouldn't try to control other people, because if you look at liberalism, it does not try to control, at least obviously.
Right.
Its control is exerted differently. Fascists try to exact control, like, directly. Basically, the NSDAP was in the bedroom with you, kind of a thing. That's how many people have put it. That's a little overkill. But they were a little bit too blunt, too over the top, too obvious in their control. That's a mistake. You have to be a back off, kind of suggest it, promote it, the propaganda aspect, kind of like Planned Parenthood. We're not forcing anyone to do anything. No, they're not, are they? And yet they're extremely effective.
Oh, absolutely.
The whole abortion lobby, extremely effective.
Right.
So just something to think about. And then the second part of this book is the pictures.
Oh, I love the pictures.
Oh, they're great, aren't they, in the quotes?
Oh, wonderful.
They've the one in particular, well, two in particular. On page 48 of our version, it has the distress signal of the 26th degree, which is your arms are crossed above your head, your two hands.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the second one is the sign of distress of the 32nd degree, which is kind of this, your two hands are interlocking at the fingers and you're mm-hmm. holding in front of your forehead.
Mm-hmm.
And then we go on to 50 and 51, the Jewish eye of God displayed on the eastern wall of the temple in the Erlangen Lodge, which is the one they fully investigated for this book, above the seat of the master. That all-seeing eye is on our dollar, it's everywhere, blah, blah, blah. Everyone who's even somewhat savvy, even people who don't really know about Freemasonry, think that eyeball is odd.
Mm-hmm.
That happens to be the great distress signal used at short distances by all Masons. And that's on page 51.
Mm-hmm.
What I find extremely interesting is that that distress signal is used in modeling magazines, in music videos,
right,
in performances, constantly.
All the time.
What does it mean? So, okay, we know it's a distress signal, but what does that mean? What does it mean from Masons to audience? And what does it mean at maybe higher levels of Masonry? Because I talked to a Mason. I met this guy at my residency. A really nice guy, blah, 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 but he was Masonry. And he told me that the number one threat to the world, and this is really interesting coming from a Mason, was the Catholic Church. And I thought, well, that's interesting. I'm going to go convert to Catholicism now.
I thought you were going to convert to Islam.
I'm going to do both.
Okay.
Anyway, point is, very interesting that they find Catholicism to be enemy number one. We know this is true because the whole history of Masonry goes back to the utmost rejection of the Catholic order, which was basically Europe. European civilization and Catholicism are intertwined. It doesn't matter if you're Catholic. You don't have to be. It just so happens that my mother was Catholic and we went through the whole catechism thing, baptism, etc., Catholic stuff. But we're not practicing. Really not at all. But I found myself wanting to identify more with it because of the fact that it was opposed to Masonry. Not modern Catholicism, but the original Catholicism. But if you listen to, for instance, the music of Sabaton, their new album, Carolus Rex, the whole thing is about how Europe was Catholic, and the whole wars of Europe, the whole creation of Europe was basically Catholic versus Protestant, the whole formation. It's an integral part of our history and who we are, our culture, everything. One can't simply just drop it like that. That's not going to work. Whether or not it can be resurrected, I don't know. Whether it should be, I don't know. But I just know that the fact that it was the number one enemy of Masons, and they still consider it so and are still taught that, according to this guy, to me is significant.
Except I think that the Catholic Church has really been infiltrated.
Absolutely.
At the higher levels.
But that is part of the continuing destruction to the final rot. So the church body is not yet dead. The Masons and the Jutsis have not killed it yet. That process is still ongoing.
Mm-hmm.
That's how I see the infiltration. The fact that they felt the need to infiltrate it and that they want it to embrace aliens. And, you know, maybe we should be giving people pharmaceuticals. Maybe abortion is okay. We're pro-gay marriage. Everything that the Catholic Church stood for, it is negating or backtracking on and going into weird places like with the alien thing. That's part of the destructive process that hasn't yet completed.
Right.
Sense that this, the destruction of the church and the destruction of European civilization and peoples is kind of like the two tracks of the destruction that's going on to the New World Order. It, those aren't necessarily the only two tracks. I think all peoples are under attack, especially Islam right now. But the attack against Islam is more a Jutsi attack than a Mason attack, in my opinion. The Masons are really after the church, more or less. I think the Jutsis are done with the Catholic Church as far as the real core destruction. They've moved on to Islam. So I see maybe a resurrected Catholic Church and certainly Islam itself as the real hope for humanity. I definitely feel that way about Islam. I think it's the last pillar that must fall before all is lost, you know, in my opinion, because unfortunately I don't see the Catholic Church going back. I don't see it.
Oh no, I don't either.
Destruction. In my opinion, it's too late. We're on this track and it isn't changing. It can change if we all want to create the circumstances for that change, but I don't see that anytime soon. But that's kind of like, this book just talks about the Catholics, how they were attacked. It isn't pro-Catholic. This particular publication is talking about the Catholics as another threat, not as great as the, you know, the Masons, of course. But I thought that was interesting because it negates these people that go, oh, the Jesuit Nazi connection.
Right.
They had an official publication that said the Jesuits were a problem, too. The Nazis, the Germans, the NS Germans, did not like the international quality of the Jesuits. If it was going to be something, it needed to be nationalistic, not international, trying to impose its will on everything.
Right.
But again, that's just a matter of opinion. I guess that's pretty much all I need to say about that. But what is interesting is if one goes to vigilantcitizen.com and you just look up symbolic picks of the month, he has several. Every month he does symbolic picks. Almost every single picture from the magazine or the internet he called it from has that great distress signal, the all-seeing eye. There'll be some model putting a triangle around their eye like Beyonce or, you know, a Miley Cyrus or whatever the case is. There are many other things that are very strange. For example, why do Disney Club actors all turn out to be nutcases later? Britney Spears, Justin Timberlake, the girl from Clarissa Says It All, I can't think of her name. What you'll see is that there's a transformation that takes place between being in that Mickey Mouse Club thing and then going on to be like this bizarro later, you know, falling into drugs, being promiscuous. What happened basically to Britney Spears and Miley Cyrus, how the unfolding of like a destructive process in all these girls. Very interesting because this is all planned.
Sure.
And I suspect Mickey Mouse Club has a role in that. All of Hollywood, everything, the whole industry, all of it is in this Masonic destructive process. Everything they do is deliberate. There's a reason they're showing the audience all-seeing eye all the time.
Sure.
These things. I definitely want to look at this movie, Pan's Labyrinth. He has a good assessment of that. I think I'm going to sit and watch the movie because I want to see how they attack and demonize fascism in the Catholic Church in that movie. And of course, Pan is Satan. And the girl goes to Satan to receive enlightenment.
Mm-hmm.
And he leads her through the labyrinth to final enlightenment, which is completely a Masonic temple. That's what, with the checkerboard pattern and all that, that's what her ultimate mm-hmm. enlightenment. And in the movie, her father, who beats her, is a horrible person, screaming at her all the time. He represents fascist Catholic Spain and that whole order of the patriarchal fascist evil one. And here's dear Satan, who's going to set you free. He'll hand you the dagger. You go ahead and take your life and escape that oppression. This kind of cleansing process, like you kill yourself to find the enlightenment, the self-destruction. You're not actually shown in the movie, I guess, whether she killed herself or whether her father stabbed her, but she dies. And that's when she ultimately finds enlightenment. Very strange, though. And I think the movie may be worth watching for those who are investigators of this symbology. Just very weird.
Yeah.
So with that, I guess we can go on to our next one. How about managing our perception of the Third Reich?
Mm-hmm.
This one is basically a response to those who scream at me that I'm a Nazi apologist, a fascist, and a liar. Garrett Phillips, who is a very real person over there in Islington, London, UK. He probably hates me, too. I wonder if he's ever heard any of this. But I named names. Ethan B. Katz, Randall Bitework, and Dr. Mike Wattico, my former thesis advisor in the book. You're all named. I've been persecuted by all of them in one respect or another. Certainly not accosted like Robert Forson or anything like that, nearly killed. But being persecuted is, it's hard no matter what it is. Even if someone's name calling, it's still a challenge to deal with.
Of course it is.
Basically, this is my answer to those people. It's divided into three parts. The first part is part one, Nazi apologist, fascist, liar. The second part is about the Warsaw Uprising and correcting the problems with that. And then the last part is they also fought for Hitler. And that basically talks about the different minorities. It's kind of an expanded summary with updated information of what is contained in Black Nazis 2.
Mm-hmm.
But people can read that book to get the full story, but it's basically just a summation of that book's most important points. And it is revised since that time. Just so people know, the body of Black Nazis 2 is 2009. And on top of the body of the text, that's not including the introduction, which I added later and amended once to include updated information, and the epilogue. Those were added after the fact.
Mm-hmm.
The body of it is a 2009 master's thesis. So it is kosher, and it is 2009.
Right.
2013. There's updated information since then. So just know that you're reading something that's already a little bit outdated. So, of course, the four Powerwolf publication books go with that book. They dovetail with it, okay, with the updated information. So that also includes the controversy of Black Nazis 2. All these people that are going, how can you say this? You know, the whole controversy surrounding that thesis is dealt with there. Of course, I'm currently working on the story of the Sabak El Sher family, which was a mulatto family that lived in Germany under Hitler and did quite well, considering. And the two sons, one of them served as a medic. He went missing in the Battle of Stalingrad, sadly, at the very, very end. I mean, he almost made it through the whole thing and then goes missing.
Sadly,
they never confirmed whether Horst Sabak El Sher died, but he went missing. But the fact that he was a medic, that's not exactly a lowly job.
Right.
A mixed race mulatto in Hitler's Germany, as they like to call it, Hitler Germany. And then the other brother who was older, Herbert, he wasn't in as good a health. So they were going to draft him for the Volkssturm, but they said, you're not in the best health and you're older. We're not going to do that. Isn't that interesting? Those evil, horrible, racist monsters who wanted to liquidate every mixed race person.
That's right.
Did not want him to serve for fear that, you know, he's not physically able. That just counteracts a lot of myth.
Sure. Now, I know that you've also covered in Managing Our Perception of the Third Reich, that you've covered the Mexican workers that were being deloused at the U.S. border, and the Americans used Cyclone B to disinfect Mexican clothing.
Yep. Yeah, that was Alexander Cockburn wrote a very good essay about that.
Right.
Americans use Zyklon B to disinfect Mexicans' clothing and other personal belongings upon entry into the U.S. Alexander Cockburn, Zyklon B on the U.S. border, counterpunch.
Right.
That's something I accessed back in 2010. I put my access dates on all of my online stuff. So if it does ever go missing,
and you can find it again,
we'll know that, oh, well, that was 2 years ago or 3 years ago.
Sure. Whatever.
Right. And Luis Munoz, my friend, he's the one that wrote the section, the most of the section on Sinarchism, Hispanidad in the Berlin-Madrid Alliance in Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
I basically address the whole German anti-Anglo angle. And then he talks about the quote-unquote Nazis in Mexico. There's actually called Los Nazis in Mexico.
Mm-hmm. And then,
I know. And it's, of course, typical nonsense. But he does talk about the Trotsky assassination.
Mm-hmm.
The Gestapo more than likely helped Stalin nail that guy, which mm-hmm. isn't necessarily a bad thing because the Germans didn't like Trotsky either.
Right.
So, hey, you know, that was during the whole Russo-German pact. So that was okay. But kind of interesting because people don't know that. They go, oh, the Gestapo worked with the NKVD or whatever to take out Trotsky in Mexico. Interesting. That's something that that author addresses.
Right.
But anyway, he goes through, he kind of summarizes that thesis and some other points about how Roosevelt got Mexico into the war on America's side, got Mexico to cut off oil to the fascist countries,
mm-hmm.
all that in his preparation, his path to war. Okay, and then the other Nazis is basically my, in fact, it is my interview with Frank Joseph.
Oh my gosh.
Just mm-hmm. He actually gave a great interview. I got to hand it to him. So, you know, that's good. That's the good that came out of it. And mm-hmm. it is expanded with a lot more information added that couldn't be put into the featured article that went into New Dawn magazine, mm-hmm. which is who he contributes to or who he works for. I put a lot of pictures in there to show people how racist Hitler is, shaking hands with Poles, signing stuff with Ion Antonescu, being very evil with President Emil Hasha.
Right.
Being an absolute monster with Matsuoka. How dare you, Hitler? Bowing down to King Prajat Haipak of Thailand. Just very evil pictures there. The ones I found most interesting were H.H. Kung's visit to the Berghof. So this Chinese businessman who was extremely wealthy and quite prominent in China during World War II comes with a whole slew of Chinese nationalist businessmen. And they're all chit-chatting with Hitler. He's laughing in the pictures, shaking his hand, hanging out with these Chinese people. I thought, you know, that's powerful imagery there.
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm.
But the Führer was meeting with Chinese and Arab leaders.
And Japanese, all kinds of people. Mm-hmm.
Many Slavic leaders. Okay, Ferenc Zelasi, Milan Stojadinovic. I can't say these names.
Oh, I think you do great.
Iraqi Prime Minister Rashid al-Gailani. I have his picture. The Indian leader Subhas Chandra Bose. And yet he did not meet with Roosevelt, Churchill, Hitler. To meet with Churchill. Lewis Kilter talks about that in Churchill's Deception.
Right.
He said the opportunity to meet with him wouldn't. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
So, you know, it's more stuff that throws wrenches in the whole German racist thing. So that's basically that. He asks many good questions. I give answers. This is an expanded version.
Mm-hmm.
So it's 77 pages.
Yeah. So I like all the pictures. Mm-hmm.
I have our new logo on page 78, which is sure to rile the masses. Hitler with that little girl.
Right.
Love that picture.
Yes. He loved children and animals. He was just...
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And the new video we made is, it's over... Initially, it was like 2,500 images, but it kept crashing.
Ah.
The software, it couldn't handle it. And we were trying to do it in high def. And I've been, you know, surfing on the internet, and I've found many sites that just have thousands of Hitler pictures. Very funny what the guy says. I'll tell you that in a minute. But basically, it's been cut down to just over 1,100 images. But the three-part video on veraiconapublishers.wordpress.com is over 1,100 images of Hitler.
Wow.
Bad. And it's all high def. 1080 HD. So it took a while to upload
okay,
that.
Give that website again.
It's Vera Icona Publishers. WordPress.com. And I have a personal blog, too, that's linked from that. One need only click the picture of Bill Cowlitz on the right. You can look him up sometime. He's interesting. Very interesting German from East Germany, let's put it that way. Anyway, so what were we saying? The pictures of Hitler. Oh, this one guy, young guy. He has a picture, or he has a site that's specific, like a Tumblr site, that's specifically dedicated to pictures of Hitler. And he has this cute little conversation between him and his mother. And his mother goes, you know, I'm really concerned about you. You've been in all day. You're on that computer all day long, blah, 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 blah. What are you doing? You need to get out. He goes, Mom, calm down. I'm already on my 8,000th picture of Hitler. Oh, my. That's funny. He's really got a lot. So I should send you that link, too.
Okay.
Really good rare ones. So now we can go on to our last book, the most important one for sure, Werewolves of the Iron Cross, Albion and Zion United. And basically, this is the book where I introduce the terminology Britzy, Jutesy, Britzism, Jutesism, Motzism, Motzies for the Masons, because we all like to talk about Nazism and Nazis.
Right.
You know, slightly in jest, but also somewhat serious. And of course, I put silly and stupid. So is Nazi and Nazism, or Nazism, as some like to put two I's. But the inanity prevails. We still use these terms.
Mm-hmm.
It's time to turn the tables and promote a totally new view of World War II. This is it.
Mm-hmm.
This would be the book. And then, of course, I do have Yankeeism. Yankees. Now, the Mexicans called the Americans Yankees, Y-A-N-K-I. It mm-hmm. is derogatory. They didn't say that in a nice way. The Yankees were not, that wasn't a nice way to say it. So it's an epithet like Nazi. So it's not Yanktsy. I've noticed some people put Yanktsy.
Mm-hmm.
Then the other one is Poltsy for the Poles.
Oh, yeah.
There are a couple times. Basically, this book, as the translator put it, is about the English-Jewish alliance, how it came to be, what it is, how the Anglo-Saxon race and the Jewish race are one and the same, how they share the same religious foundation via Puritanism and Judaism, which are basically the same ideology.
Mm-hmm.
Just one is for Anglo-Saxons. It deals with British Israel or Britzy Israel, as I would put it. So anyone who kind of espouses the British Israel thesis, they can certainly read what the NSDAP thought about that, because it's quite clear in this book. It is slight terminology changes from the past. Like, for example, we use the term CEO instead of saying like the head of the company or
right.
director. We'll use the term CEO so that it's more applicable to today.
Right.
But the translation's true to the original. You're going to get the same exact, you know, meat, et cetera. And then, of course, the terms Jutesy, Jutesism, et cetera, are in there. And those are, of course, not original. But that's basically it. I mean, just going through the table of contents, the first part, aristocracy, plutocracy, it talks about how the aristocratic principle became the wealth principle. And that when England traded in that principle for wealth-based nobility, where you could buy your way into power and it didn't matter how that money was acquired, that's really when they sold their soul to the Jutesies.
Mm-hmm.
Why we have the problems we do today. When one reads this book, and of course the Union Jackal, this is really goes right with it. The two were put back-to-back like that for a reason. One will get how it started, what the base of our world problems today are, because they've literally passed from Britain to America. And of course, America is a former British colony. We think and act as Britons.
Mm-hmm.
That really is the gist of this. So when we think of how the Britzies got involved with Palestine, the whole chaos that just in the way the Jutsis got them into that, it's almost exactly the same process. One could almost just change the names and go, gee, this was written yesterday.
Right.
About America and Israel. That's how pertinent how the Jutsis got the Britsis into Israel and how we're in there as a result of that same destructive relationship.
Right.
Very right. Interesting. Mm-hmm. It's great. And he really sums things up. He goes through it fast. So, you know, you're not going to read like a 500-page book on the Rothschilds. You're just going to get the important points. Now, I didn't correct anything factually on his part. So if the original author has an error, a factual error, like, wait a minute, that's proven or whatever, I think this is pure bias here, that's not corrected. That's up to the reader to go, wait a minute, he was wrong there. We wanted it to be the original, untainted, uncorrected German text so that people could read exactly what Germans could read at that time.
Great.
Because their point of view, including errors, omissions, etc., bias, is extremely important. We're seeing how they saw the world and how the government or an official publishing house taught their people the history, this history. So we left that, and it was originally published in 1940. This is based on the third printing of that text. All the pictures, all the original images are there with original captions. Talks about the Opium War. Every time I see a bottle of Vidal Sassoon shampoo, I'm every time I see it, I think of the Opium War now.
Yeah.
The Sassoons did that, people, so quit buying Vidal Sassoon. Boycott. And, of course, we'd call that an anchor or an association in NLP. Every time I see Vidal Sassoon, I think Opium War, criminal. And then lastly, we can just touch on German rule in Russia, 1941 to 1945, by Alexander Dowlin. I finished it.
Ah, okay.
This is a great old book. He touches on a lot of other books, too, that I went ahead and bought. Several. Not all of them, of course, but several. Not all of them are available. Some of them are like master's theses from like 1957, so they're not really available. But overall, the books he recommended were pretty good. But what I have to say about this is it corrects a lot of the myths. It really does. He talks about, for example, the treatment of the Slavs, how it wasn't sweeping, it wasn't uniform. He goes into all the backbiting, the arguing. Just there was a lot of shenanigans behind the scenes, especially in the East. And I think the real rising star of this book, at least in my opinion, is Alfred Rosenberg. I think of him completely differently now. And of
really?
Course, we've gone over this before. He was not Jewish in any way, shape, or form, in spite of his
name.
Just, he was the most humanitarian, the most quote-unquote liberal, if you will, of the Eastern occupation authorities. He was put in charge of the Ostministerium, which is like the Eastern Ministry of Occupation. And basically, Erich Koch was supposed to go through him to get things approved for his own policies in the Ukraine. Basically, everybody, all the Gauleiters, etc., were supposed to go through Rosenberg. They were supposed to get approval from the Ostministerium for whatever policies they had. And Rosenberg was very much of the opinion that good treatment is going to beget rewards.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to make us win the war. We need these people on our side. We can't force this militarily. It can't happen. We need a political victory too. Unfortunately, and this is where I must be a little bit critical of Hitler, etc., they were not receptive to that. And Hitler said, oh, he's just a sentimentalist. They're too sentimental. That silly intellectual Rosenberg, blah, blah, blah. But actually, Rosenberg was right. He was right. And the thing is it didn't even have to be genuine. And of course, Dowlin acts like all the good treatment that the Slavs did receive under the Germans was purely practical. None of it was ever genuine. That's an absolute lie. First of all, just from the pictures, if one looks at the pictures presented by like Antonio Munoz, etc., of the interactions between Germans and even the authorities and the Slavic peoples. And then number two, he's leaving out the human factor of the German officials. They were human beings just like anyone else. They had feelings, etc. They weren't automatons. They weren't robots. You can't possibly believe that every one of those NS officials was so ideologically entrenched and driven that they couldn't look at a Slavic person and go, you know, we need to treat them better, or I feel bad, and have no empathy. That's nonsense. It can't happen. And of course, military personnel, military officials, Ostministerium officials, including Rosenberg, were like, look, you can't do this. We can't treat these people like this. And it wasn't simply out of practicality and, oh, we want to win the war, so we're going to fool these people and pretend to care about them. You can't pretend to care. Now, Koch was over the top. He treated the Ukrainians overall very poorly. I have not actually done a systematic in-depth study of Erich Koch. I'm going to have to after reading this, because he's presented as an absolute monster and a creep. And if Hitler approved of him being in that position and allowed him to step over Rosenberg and just completely bypass the Eastern Ministry and go straight to Hitler with Bormann supporting him, and knowing how bad his policies were and how much it was affecting negatively Ukrainian policy and the attitude of the population, one has to be critical of Hitler on that issue. And of course, Erich Koch as well.
Mm-hmm. So,
something I'm going to have to study more, because I don't know if we're getting a completely biased picture. What I do know is that the information that Dallin presents from Rosenberg are direct quotes. And Rosenberg had to just, he had it out with Koch several times. And he hated him. So we know that there was tension there. And we know that Koch thought that Rosenberg was too liberal, too sentimental. He wanted to be easy on the Ukrainians. He was a Slav lover, etc. So we know that some of it's true. But how bad he was, I don't know. Dallin really attacks him. One of the other problems with Dallin's book is that he relies so much on IMT stuff. It's so
much. Oh, right. Oh, nobody should do that.
Exactly. So unless he's quoting like a diary, direct quote, where we have a German backup version that can be verified as original, mm-hmm. we need to be careful about any kind of IMT evidence. He doesn't really touch on the Holocaust so much, doesn't in fact mention that by name at any point. This was put out in 57. That might have been before the frenzy.
Mm-hmm.
But he does mention incredible atrocities, the most inhuman regime ever. Hitler was from hell, kind of a thing.
Right.
So you have to deal with a little bit of that. But overall, not a bad book. It dispels a lot of myths. Exonerates Rosenberg completely, in my opinion. I can't, like, after reading this book, I cannot believe that we put him to death. He did absolutely nothing to deserve a death sentence.
Well, I guess you could say that about a lot of people that the U.S. put to death.
I mean, he went out of his way to try to save Ukrainian lives and Slavic mm-hmm. work with them and help them and get them incorporated into the Reich as little sovereign entities. It does not make any sense, but sheer vengeance against that whole regime. Just incredible. I mean, that death right there is very, there's no excusing that one. Sorry. I have his memoirs. I've read them once. It's been a while. They're very interesting. You know, he really was very pro-Slavic, considering he started out very anti-Russian and basically wanted to collect the Eastern peoples in you know, the Baltic bloc, the Balkan bloc, Ukraine, etc., into kind of a bulwark that weren't quite as high up as the Germans. So you still had the Herrenvolk principle of this is going to be stratified political power-wise.
Mm-hmm.
People are going to have sovereignty to a degree, but you're still going to be kind of in an empire. It was basically, at its heart, German manifest destiny. It was no different, other than Polk's manifest destiny was wipe out the Mexican army and kick them out.
Exactly.
Rosenberg's was, we're going to only deport some of the population. We're going to amalgamate some of them, let them maintain some of their culture. It said it wasn't as brutal. It wasn't as cutthroat, imperial, as even ours was. And they certainly weren't going to mass exterminate entire ethnic groups like we did Native Americans in our Manifest Destiny. So, you know, in that comparison, it was much more lenient, much more adapted to a modern age that had more liberal principles, more humanitarian principles. But he wanted to kind of contain what he called Muscovy, which was your base ethnic Russians, not wipe them out. There was no oblivion of Russia as we know it. It was merely taking Eastern Europe and Western Russia, which was Ukraine, into the Reich, that would no longer be part of a Soviet empire or a Russian empire, but a German empire or a greater Germany. They were not going to wipe out Russia. It was going to exist further east. The demarcation line was going to be further east. So that whole extermination thing goes out the door in this book. And then, yes, there was going to be mass deportation. Now, Hasso's talk with you talked a little bit about that in Poland. This guy doesn't talk about Poland at all, but there were forced relocations.
Right.
We can't get around that. That is considered a war crime. It was probably a mistake for the Germans to do that. But I always ask the question, who hasn't done that? Who isn't doing that? If we recall, Mr. Sarkozy, before he was booted out, forcibly rounded up gypsies and threw them out of France just recently. Where were the screaming liberal humanitarians then? Then we have the case of the Palestinian Arabs, who are literally being displaced in the land that they've been in at least as long as Jutsis, longer in most cases, because most of the Jutsis came from Europe. Give me a break.
Right.
Forcible mass deportation. And then we have the modern crime going on right in front of our eyes of Sudanese and other African immigrants being literally rounded up, put in concentration camps in Israel today, and forcibly deported to anywhere they can dump them off in Africa. They don't even care if they go back to their original homeland. They just want to kick them out.
Right.
And they've firebombed the immigrant camps. They're saying that they're committing all these crimes. Many of them are denying that they're committing these crimes. They firebombed a kindergarten, for goodness sake.
Ugh.
The Jutsis did. Now, whether or not one likes Africans, that's irrelevant. The point is, if we're going to hold that as a crime, then it is a crime anywhere, including Jutsi Israel.
Absolutely.
They're around that. And considering the context today in our worldview that we've adapted, which is Masonic Jutsi, that is inexcusable. See, back in Hitler's day, that was much more acceptable. Today, it's absolutely unacceptable. It should be. That's where I would encourage people to consider context. Nothing exists in a vacuum, and it does not matter. I don't care what any historian says. It doesn't matter what time it was. Time doesn't exist. There are only events. Just because the Native Americans were wiped out so many years ago, it's not any less or more relevant than any other wipeouts in the historical continuum. So I don't like that whole, well, that happened a long time ago.
Exactly.
Well, this event in Israel is happening right now.
Right now. Mm-hmm.
What does anyone have to say about it? That's pretty much all I have to say on that front. Not a bad book, but I mean, you know, his bias is obvious.
Sure.
And of course, many NS officials were pro-Slavic, treated them great, and others were not so much, like Erich Koch. You had both, and they fought with each other over this. Just like today, with all of our group infighting, etc., the NSDAP was going head-to-head, screaming matches. I'm going to climb over you. It was just as much backbiting and fighting.
Well, I think anytime you get a group of people together that are going to have different opinions, they're going to want to exert their opinion over somebody else. That's just a natural kind of thing in any group.
Exactly. And this even happened, and I addressed this in, I believe it's A Controversy of Black Nazis 2, where I addressed the infighting amongst the top NS officials about African policy.
Sure.
Many NS officials who said, we don't mind Africans being here. We're even okay with a little bit of mixing. I mean, if you need to put mulattoes in certain jobs to have a job, do it. We're not going to protest that. What is so interesting, and this comes out in this Sabak El Sher book I'm translating, the German public was actually pressuring the government not to employ Africans and black people. It wasn't vice versa, so that the government was forced to defend the black workers and make sure they got employment in some area. That is the total inverse of what we are taught.
Right.
It was from top down. No, it wasn't. Some things were from bottom up, just like in any country. And we shouldn't be of the opinion that the NS, you know, the whole NS government, et cetera, was all roses and everybody got along.
Right. Obviously they didn't, or they wouldn't have tried to take Hitler out.
Death scene. You ever seen those jutsis going at each other over the table trying to punch each other?
Oh, yes. What is it they say? If you have two in a room, there's going to be three opinions. I mean, they just...
Oh, yeah. So, I mean, there were almost fist fight type of arguments going on, even in the NS German apparatus.
Sure.
Yeah. So, kind of interesting.
Well, it's been lovely having you on the program.
It's been lovely being on after so long.
Well, we've made up for it.
We have.
Well, I'm just delighted with your books. I think it's wonderful that you're moving ahead, that you're, I'm proud of you. You've done an excellent job on these books. I'm very impressed. I really am.
I appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Yeah, very professional.
Yeah, always improving. And we can, of course, finish the NLP talk some other time, because there's a lot.
Oh, yes.
Yep. All right.
All righty. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
All righty. We'll talk to you soon.
Talk to you soon.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.